track session number 4618, Reel 1.
Of March 1936.
Why did you decide to join?
Well, I'd left school at 15 and was doing clerical jobs, and I was bitten by this, you know, the war was coming up, the 35s, 36. There was a whacking great advertising campaign for the Army, Navy and Air Force, and I was bitten by a bug to travel. I first went to the Navy headquarters in Birmingham. They rejected me. I'd had a little bit of heart trouble, so they said, which mother knew nothing about. I'm the eldest of nine children, and there's eight of us still alive. Whilst I was at secondary school, there came a period when we had to be medically examined, and the doctor said to mother, she's still alive, very, very weak and frail now. When did your son have rheumatic fever, Mrs. Douglas? And she said, oh, he hasn't had it. He's had German measles. And at that time, I had about 18 months away from school when I was nine and a half, ten. And the doctor said, because the conditions then were nothing like they are today, you know. The doctor said, well, he has, because there's a slight heart murmur that he's left him with. And from now on, he's not to play any games and do any PE at school. I think I was about nine and a half then. About that. So I used to sit out at school. Am I labouring it?
No.
I haven't started yet. I used to sit out at school in PE lessons, you know, sit on a chair. And I felt all right. Anyway, this went on, and I left school having had no physical activity at all. And then along came, I left school and I became a junior clerk into a clothing firm, and dull and boring, and I wanted to move. And I was bitten by one of the adverts, you know, join the army or join the navy and see the world. So without telling mother or dad, or anyone, I wrote off for a booklet, and I got an invitation to go to the Navy in Birmingham. I went there, and they rejected me because of my, they said, my heart condition. So I said, I went around to the RAF the same day, within the hour, and I said nothing about, I don't think I told a lie. I don't think I had to say, well, have you ever been examined? Anyway, they accepted me. Within an hour of the Navy turning me down. So eventually, on the 2nd of March 1936, I got the Queen's shilling and went to Uxbridge. And I always remember sitting there in the canteen that evening. Four of us went down from Birmingham, two lads from Stoke, one from Kindler, and myself. Complete strangers. Hadn't been away from home before. And sitting in the mess there about 8 o'clock that night, an old man, about my age as I am now, came in, he got a beard, and someone said, and he started chatting to us, and apparently he was the station commander. I can't think of his name. He had a beard, and someone said that he was allowed to grow his beard because he was badly wounded or some trouble in the war, some scar. I can't think of his name. I can see his face now. Anyway, where was I? Oh, and from there we went to Orpington. The panic was beginning then, you know, of conscription, of getting chaps to go into the forces. I went to RAF Orpington and did basics, drill, rifle drill, shooting, the rest. And then I was posted as, what's the term? Clerk General Duties to the School of Photography in Farnborough. And at Farnborough, I had clerical duties in the orderly room. Men's documents, movements, rations, and the like, you know. Excuse me. But I found when I was there that... Do you know RAF Farnborough?
No.
It's where flying started, you know. There's the Royal Aircraft Establishment where they used to do all the experiments on the one side of the field, and there was two little hangars. They're still there today from the First World War, where the boys who were brought to Farnborough, I don't know how long the course was, 6 months something, and taught to be aerial photographers, which is fairly new in those days. And I was the clerk in the orderly room. And I would always have to take some time during the day, some messages from the orderly room, nearly half a mile to the flight hangars on a bicycle or walk it. And the aircraft they had there then were, Hawker Audax. That was the first. I should have brought a logbook. And I used to go around the hangars, you know, after delivering the message and try and scrounge trips, which I did. I first flew, and I got into trouble because I didn't tell my corporal, I forget his name, Sanderson. I was wanted as ballast. I was always after trips. I got my first trip with a flying officer, Robinson, who came from Wolverhampton, who was subsequently killed on an Empire Air Day, 37. Yeah, this takes me back. Anyway, I had my first trip ever off the ground with this flying officer, Robinson, who was a good lad, good pilot. And back again for 35 minutes. And of course, when I got back to the office, where have you been? Blah, 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 blah. So I told the truth, and I got a rocket. I don't know. Well, I didn't get put on a charge as they used to do there. I got away with it anyway. I stayed at the School of Photography for 9 months. And in that time, I logged up about five or six flying hours, you know, as passenger, sitting in the back seat of, you know what an Audax looks like?
Yes.
You know, open cockpit with a monkey chain came up between your legs and fastened you to the bottom.
What was the monkey chain for?
To keep you in, you know, in case of aerobatics. Oh, it's beautiful. Lovely. There's nothing like flying. Where were we?
What did the crews think of the Audax?
I don't know. I wasn't close enough to them. I used to go down and scrounge a flip, as we call it, with anybody who was there. If they said, oh, somebody ballast needed, yes. My second trip was over the Isle of Wight. Beautiful. Never been up in the air before. It's glorious. You fly?
Mm-hmm.
It's glorious, isn't it? I think that if there's a next life and I can't be a man, I want to be a bird, preferably a male bird. But it's beautiful up there. Sorry, I'm digressing.
Could you tell me what your daily routine would have been at Farnborough?
What it was as a clerk?
Yes.
Yes, get up in the morning, go on parade. Everyone, we went on parade with the boy entrance. On parade was a flight sergeant pilot who usually did the adjutant's duties. I forget his name. Beautiful pilot, everyone said. Big tubby chap, photographer. He always did the adjutant's job on parade, and then along would come Flight Lieutenant Earl to take the final things and dismiss us. And the boys then went to their lectures in the school. And I went into the orderly room with Corporal... nice chap. He was married and lived in the married quarters. And I worked there with Corporal, I forget his name, nice chap. But he didn't like me scrounging off to try and get trips. Still, I still went on doing it. It was there to... my routine. First thing I did, I think, was the... had to do a parade state. Oh, this was before the parade. The parade commander always had to have a piece of paper, a printed RAF form. You know, these bloody forms. It had a number, I don't know what it was. It was called parade state, on which was the number of officers, airmen, cadets, all sorts of, that were and NCOs that were actually on parade. So that when the adjutant handed him this piece of paper, or you send to the adjutant, he knew exactly what people he had on parade. I don't know why. It sometimes is cooked anyway. You know, if somebody was the you know, one of your friends were still in his kip or hadn't shaved or still eating breakfast, I could cook it. I don't mind that being recorded. Nothing wrong with that. The parade state was given on parade. After that, what did I do after that? Oh, the ration book had to be done. The people in the cookhouse had to know how many meals to prepare for 3 days ahead or something like that. The ration thing, pretty boring clerical stuff. Oh, and then every day we had DROs, daily routine orders, which had to be stuck up all over the camp.
What were daily routine orders?
They were, oh dear. Any promotions were put on them, I don't know why. Promotions? I didn't know any demotions. Oh, one during the war. Promotions, courses which airmen could attend, voluntary, or compulsory courses. Anything that the CO thought the men should know of that day. So it was, I think it was everybody's duty to look at DROs every day. They're put up in the canteen, in the officer's mess, airman's mess, and all the other messes, you know. I think it was, I can't remember. I should imagine it was. DROs were printed. What else? I think they've changed them now to PROs or something. Personnel occurrence reports. What else did I do? I was looking out the window at the flyers, actually. I was there when some Stanforth, was it? Broke the height record? No, he was with Orlebar on the Snyder Trophy, wasn't he? Stanforth. I was there when a chap named Adams, I think he was a flight Louis, actually watched him take off. Again, I shouldn't have been there. When he broke the world's altitude record in a, I forget what it was called. He had one of these, the first pressurized suit or something like that. Took off from the aircraft establishment. That'd have been 37. I think his name was Adams. What else? Routine duties. Oh, I don't like routine. What else did I do? Scrounge around, try and get trips up in the air. Try to get my arse off the ground. Played a lot of sport. I played a lot of tennis there. There was a chap named Stowe, a photographer, who was on the permit, because as well as they had civvy instructors. Dunton was one, nice chap. Bound to be dead now. They had a squadron leader commanding the School of Photography. Flight Lieutenant Alfred Earle was his second in command. And then there were no other commissioned officers, but they had a line of instructor, ex-airmen, I suppose they were, instructing in photography in a different aspect. One was named Dunton. He was a nice chap, very friendly. Where was I? Oh, I learned to play tennis there with Stowe and Shepherd. These were permanent members of the photography staff, leading aircraftmen. I think Shepherd was a corporal. We all shared the same billet, you know, about 30 beds in a... Oh, another chap there was good. A chap named Sampson. I think he made good in the American Air Force. I think he got an American DFC. Sammy, we called him. He was a Jew. I think his people had plenty of money because we went on his motorbike once from Farnborough. I was duty clerk. We used to duty clerk for a whole week, which meant you had to stay on camp. And perhaps only once in a week were you needed after office hours to do something, you know. But they always had to take a message or find the cipher officer or the duty officer. And once with Sammy, he had a motorbike. So he must have had money in those days. And we went down to see his parents at Brighton. I was on duty. And coming back, I was on the pillion. I couldn't ride. I could fly a Spitfire. I'm sorry. I could fly a Spitfire before I could drive a car. Because I had the opportunity. I didn't have the opportunity to drive a car. Nothing remarkable in that, but when I tell some of my friends, or used to, they think we're all ridiculous. Surely not. I'm sorry, I'm lost.
You said earlier that you joined at a time when the expansion in the RAF was occurring because of the impending war. To what extent were you personally conscious of an impending war at that
not
time?
Not conscious at all. I was young. I was the eldest of nine children. We weren't very well off. My father was out of work quite a lot. He ended up a storekeeper. Bless him. And I don't know what your religious feelings are, but I'm a don't know. I hope there is something after this, but I'm a don't know. I know that's a piece of paper, and I know that says Duckford. I've been taught it, but I hope there's a life after this, because I'd like to see my dad again. I'd like to see Sammy and a lot more few friends. But shall I see him? Shall I see my dad as he was a little baby? It won't mean a thing to me, will it? Never mind, I'm digressing. Did we think anything about? No. I wanted to see the world. I think the advertisement probably hit me. You know, join the Navy or join the RAF and see the world.
Had you known anything about the promotion prospects in the RAF?
Did I know?
When you joined?
No. No, I think I've had a struggle, but I've made it. I've got RAF pilot's wings, which is an achievement for a chap who the doctor said had got a dicky heart. But I've got no bloody dicky heart. I swim every Monday morning with my kids at school in the local baths. I play football with them twice a week, out on the field. I play golf. Nothing wrong with my heart. I'm 63 years young.
Did the RAF ever find out about what the doctor had said about your heart?
No, I didn't say anything. There was one little twist. This could get some people into trouble. Oh, I don't know. It's gone. It must even Alfred Earle or George V probably did some things wrong in their life. At one stage, I was in the Middle East. When I was in the Middle East, I was with CO's name was Squadron Leader J.H. Chaplin. We called him Charlie, of course. He'd got a DFC then. He was a squadron leader. He'd brought out to the Middle East. This was at the time when Crete had gone, or was just going, and Churchill wouldn't let anything go out to the East, you know. You know, bloody stupid. We had, you know, in the Middle East, on the 3rd of September 39, there were 99 serviceable aircraft in the whole of the Middle East, and those included, so I've read since, these great big Valencias, you know, that won't sit down if the wind's blowing more than 20 knots.
You were telling a story about your heart, and you're going to say whether or not it was discovered.
Yes. When I was with Charlie Chaplin in the Middle East at Ismailia, he brought out. Jerry was dropping from Crete. Jerry was dropping magnetic mines in the canal, the Suez Canal. And Charlie Chaplin was sent out with three Wellingtons with a great big hoop around them. You've seen them, pictures of them? In it, there was about 3 or 4 miles of wire, and it was hooked to a gypsum engine inside the fuselage, which generated an electric current. And the idea, these were magnetic mines, which were pretty new, so they said. So that if here was sitting in the water a magnetic mine dropped by Jerry the night before, our aircraft would come over and fly at 60 to 80 feet above the water, switch on the current in this great big hoop hooked onto the wings, and hope to explode it. And I've got in my pocket a little picture. Do you want to see it? During this time, I was made a corporal and then made a sergeant, I think. As a clerical officer or clerical, whatever, the administration, you know, filling the forms, looking after the papers and that, and scrounging trips. I'd been in Jerusalem. This was in Egypt. I'd been in Jerusalem, and just before the outbreak of war, I'd volunteered for training as a pilot. And in those days, you had to have a flying test, which I did in a 504K Avro Tutor, you know, a big radial engine. Mm-hmm. I did a half-an-hour trip from Ramleh, and I still got the remarks somewhere that the CO made. Anyway, I got through that, and then I was due to have an interview at headquarters, where I was stationed. And then, you know, things were moving. We was pushed onto the desert, and that all went by the board. At this time, I'd come back from the desert, and I was with Charlie Chaplin's unit as an order room sergeant. And after a while, he was a smashing chap. I think he's still alive. I saw his name in the retired list about 5 years ago. D.O. Butler was his second in command. He was a flight lieutenant, I think. Dennis Butler. He was a nice chap. Sorry, Hart. Yes, we were very close. We, you know, a small unit's far better than a large unit. You know, it's far better to be on a small island than a large island. It's far better to be on a small RAF station than a large one. It's far better to be Great Britain than in this bloody common market. But that's beside the point. Well, so say I. Are you a marketeer? Worst thing we ever did. Oh dear. All right, I'm all right. Heart. Yes, the CO said to me, I think it's twice a year something to do about commissions, is, why don't you take a commission, sergeant? So I said, I never thought of it, sir. I want to fly. But at that time there was, what do they call it? Everybody was screened because of the situation in the Middle East. Churchill still hadn't sent anything out to the Middle East, you know. You know that, you must know that the war started here on the 3rd of September 39, but it didn't start on the desert till Italy declared war about the 8th of May, you know, the next year. And so we were on the desert preparing and doing all sorts of things, living on an inch and a half of water to clean your teeth, wash your socks and do everything with. Getting back, he said, why don't you take a commission? I said, I want to fly, you know. He says, all right, I put it. And I said, because he didn't know anything about the paperwork. All he did was fly bloody aeroplanes, which is what I wanted to do. Anyway, he put me up. He filled this form in, recommended me for an admin commission. I couldn't have a flying commission, because you had to go to flying school, and they'd put a clamp on this. But I could be put up for a commission in the admin, you know, being an admin officer, doing exactly the same sort of thing I do as a sergeant. So I went to Heliopolis for a medical and an interview with Air Commodore. I forget his name. Nice little chap. And at this medical, the doctor said, "I said I want to fly. You know, I don't want this really, but." I'll go along with it. And they said, well, there was an Air Ministry order, they call them AMOs, I think, then, which said that, oh dear, you can't be commissioned if you're under the age of 32 and fit for flying. That was it. Something like that, because they needed. But these Air Ministry orders applied everywhere, regardless of the situation in the Middle East, you know, when no supplies were sent out from here. So they said, you can't get this commission because you're fit for aircrew. This was talking before, and you know, I said, well, I've got a dicky heart, you know, the doctor said at school. This is the first time I mentioned it. And they're about to be all dead now, aren't they? These three doctors were. One was a wing commander. I've still got the signature on a medical thing, which I harbinged. These doctors put me down as P PU, permanently unfit, grade 1, 2 and 3. Oh, I forget the wording on the certificate. I've got it at home, tucked away somewhere. But I was... They made it so that I could... They made my medical category without... well, a few tests, I suppose. They made my medical category fit this commission, which my CO said, you know, you're good enough to be an officer like the rest of them. And so it was done. I still got it at home. Now, I'm digressing again. After that, I came back home, having done the normal tour. This will be all disjointed. Yes, I must go on with this to put the point that there was nothing wrong with my bloody heart. I came back. Eventually, I came back home as a flight sergeant, clerk, whatever it was. I came back on the Strathnava P&O boat. Sorry. From Suez, the Georgic had just been bombed in Suez Harbour then by Jerry. 1941. October, November. We got on the Strathnava, we went down to Asmara, picked up Itai prisoners from the Abyssinian War. Poor devils. Oh, we were cruel. Stuffed them in the hold, you know what the temperature is down the Red Sea. They were stuffed down there like animals. Took them across to... This was in this P&O boat. There was about 100 RAF Navy and quite a few injured chaps. And chaps like myself were what they called Timex, done their time in their 3 or 3.5 years in the Middle East and were due to come home. Took them from Asmara across to Bombay. We had 5 days at Bombay loading up supplies, down across the Indian Ocean to Port Elizabeth, loaded up with stores at Port Elizabeth, down to Durban, a couple of days in Durban, down to Cape Town, a week in Cape Town, and then right across the South Atlantic to Trinidad, Port of Spain, where rum was 1 and 6 pence in old money, a pint bottle, you know, off the shelf. We had 4 days there, and then we made a run. Because we didn't know, you know, they didn't, you know, everything was secret. You didn't know what you do, what was happening, except we were coming home. Then we ran up the eastern seaboard of the American coast, then up towards Iceland and down into Greenock, alone. On the back of the boat there was a 3 or 4 inch gun and about 4 Royal Engineers who fired it occasionally, you know, just for practice. At one stage in the fortnight coming from Cape Town across to Port of Spain, at one time there was a panic on. Nobody would tell you anything, none of the crew. And we saw the engineer lads getting mount the gun and start firing off, but we heard some gunfire, but nothing fell near us. We saw any aircraft.